I decided to continue the issue of consent that we had talked about a couple of days ago, and because that theme had not been finished. And a little bit later, I just would like to mention two interesting issues, namely the issue surrounding kidney transplants and then also heart transplants, because these are two major issues in medicine now which involve the subject of consent. But before we get that, maybe before we get to that place, maybe I should make a few other remarks surrounding the whole issue of medical ethics, which has brought us to this situation where the issue of consent has become so important, and the issue of transplantation of organs has become an issue that has concerned all of us. We are in a new situation now, dominated by technology, which is the reason why transplantation has become so important for us. How has it become so? In the 18th century and possibly still in the 19th century, practical philosophy, as it is called, still was capable of providing guidelines for a life that made that could be lived as a whole. Let me take the example of Kant's own philosophy, practical philosophy. Kant was able to provide us with a philosophy, with a practical philosophy from which theology inherited a great deal, that was able to encompass all of life, and a fairly well integrated life, where human dignity had its place, was able to be derived or to be argued for on the basis of this thought. And of course, that maintained itself right to the end of the right to the end of the 19th century, I should think. And Hegel's philosophy, for example, you can still see it. A philosophy in which, and also theologies that were derived from this philosophy, a theology or a worldview, let me say it that way, that was able to integrate all of life. But this worldview decayed. This practical philosophy, as it was called, we call it today moral philosophy or ethics, decayed into two areas. The one is ideology, and the other one is technology. Ideology and technology. Now, we have ideologies today, and the major one, of course, by which we are concerned, we talked about last night, namely Marxism. I think that there is probably another ideology prevailing the West, and I would call that existentialism. But the main concern that I have is that practical philosophy decayed into ideology and into technology, on the other hand. The reason why I say that it decayed is because we don't have any more that well-rounded intellectual basis, that well-rounded worldview in which the individual finds his place in a whole cosmos, in life as a whole. Take technology, for example, specifically medical technology. One of the main problems that patients are confronted with today is that they are no longer a person, but rather that they are merely a file folder, or they are merely information bits in a computer. And this information is being used by specialists in a large group practice. It used to be that a group practice was made up by 3 or 4, 5 or 6, but now increasingly the pattern is that that 20, 30, 40 specialists from various areas inhabit a large building, and that a patient is a piece of information, and that when he comes first for a diagnosis, he is sent around to various specialists, and they all add a little bit of information to the file or to the computer information. That is what is happening in hospitals. Now, the treatment, of course, is comparable. No longer the patient as a whole is taken into consideration, but rather a patient is sent around from specialist to specialist. That is what I would call an example of what I have said, a decay of the originally complete integration of the individual in his world, which was argued in a well-rounded system like Kant's philosophy, for example. When we today argue that the individual must have his dignity, that he must be asked for consent for organ transplantations or for organs to be taken out of his body, then we say that then we argue against this decaying of practical philosophy. Now, maybe I should just mention what the Catholic position on transplants has been in order to counter this increasing depersonalization. The Catholic position has always been that the body cannot be maimed, because the body is created in God's own image, and therefore the body is good in God's sight, and it should not be maimed. Therefore, also the Catholic Church taught that you cannot commit suicide. And for that reason, the Catholic Church has traditionally been against taking organs out of the body and putting them into putting these organs into other people, because that meant maiming the body. Now, the Catholic Church has developed a very interesting new position on this, because the Catholic Church has been put under great pressure to modify its position, its rigid position. Basing itself on the idea that one can fulfill one's self, one's being by good works, the Catholic Church taught that I can do gracious deeds. It has always thought. The Catholic Church has always taught this. Now, even though the modified in the area of organ transplantation, this meant that even though the body is maimed, I can, because I do a gracious deed to somebody else, fulfill my existence spiritually. I put up good deeds more and more, and in the eyes of God, therefore, I am more and more acceptable. From a Protestant position, of course, this is altogether unagreeable. Or disagreeable. I think the Protestant cannot accept this. If somebody decides to give an organ to somebody else, he must do it out of grace, no matter what happens to him, even though it may mean complete self-sacrifice. We can never reckon with some kind of repayment for what we are doing. If I, as a parent, decide to give my kidney to my son, or if I'm a sibling and I decide to give a kidney to my brother or my sister, if there is a good organ match, the Protestant Church teaches, if you are altogether in favor of this, and if you do it out of a gracious heart, then you must not ask the motive. You must not ask for the deeper meaning of the motive. You can do this if it is done out of a genuine feeling of grace. Now that's, or graciousness or compassion. Now that's something else than having psychological pity. And for that reason, the Protestant theologian, the minister who is counseling in a hospital, must make a clear distinction, I think, between a psychological motivation and a Christian motivation. And the Christian theologian or the Christian minister can, can engage in such discourse with patients or with possible donors. Now, I would like to illustrate how important it is that the proper motive is used by a case that has made history, in which two twins were in this situation that. Leonard Marsden, it's the Marsden case, M-A-R-S-D-E-N, Leonard Marsden was to be a donor of a kidney to his twin brother Leon Marsden, who had a total kidney failure of both kidneys. Perhaps it should be mentioned that, medically it should be mentioned that live kidneys are the best kidneys. But they present also the main medical, the main ethical problems, because it means taking out an organ out of somebody else, and that means maiming the body. Now, when I go through this with my students, then they almost invariably say, oh, shouldn't a person who has two kidneys give a kidney to somebody else if there is a good organ match and if that is the best way to help somebody who has total kidney failure. And then I always emphasize that it is a major medical intervention. You are to the donor, if you take out a kidney, it's a major medical intervention. You maim a body that is otherwise perfectly healthy. And a cardinal rule in medical practice is always that you should take only so much risk. The risk must of harm must always be less than the possible benefit. Now, when you take out a kidney from a perfectly healthy person, obviously the risk is much higher than any possible good. You don't do the donor any good at all. To the contrary, you do him a great deal of harm. The situation is complicated by the fact that what I call the decay of practical philosophy into technology manifests itself in the whole area of medical progress, because here you have a technology that is independent, that is making progress all by its own without being integrated into the whole. This is the situation with which we are faced, I think, in our society as a whole. And in the transplant technology, you are faced with one such singular, one such independent aspect in the whole of medical progress by itself. Physicians are interested in making progress in transplant technology with the understanding that ultimately it will help mankind. But the problem is that very often when these first steps in a new direction are made, very grave harm is done to those with whom experiments are being made. Now in 1957, in the case of Leon and Leonard Marsden, kidney transplantation was experimental in nature. Today it can no longer be considered, today it is permissible no longer to consider kidney transplants as experimental. So the ethical considerations now are different than they were at that time. But let me tell you what has happened in this case. Leon Marsden, as I had said, was a boy, I think 17 years of age, and he had total kidney failure. Now, it was experimental, the transplantation procedure was experimental at that time, and for that reason, the physicians were not simply willing to take out a kidney from Leonard, his twin brother. For that reason, they thought that a court order had to be obtained in order to protect the physicians and to protect everybody else involved. Now, it's very interesting how the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled in 1957. It ruled that Leonard Marsden should be permitted to give the kidney to his twin brother Leon, because if he would not, then grave emotional impact would be suffered by Leonard. Today we don't argue that way anymore. Today we don't consider anymore the emotional impact that somebody might suffer. Specifically, Paul Ramsey argues that the Supreme Court made a mistake in arguing in this way. The better argument would have been that Leonard Marsden could do it if he is convinced that his twin brother needs to continue to live and that he wants to do it out of free grace, a theological argument. But the psychological argument of grave emotional harm being suffered by Leonard, the donor, implies that this grave emotional harm is less than the possible physical death of Leonard. You must understand what happens. A kidney is taken out, yes, and then you have only one kidney left. It's true that you can live with two kidneys, with only one kidney. But supposing you have a kidney infection, which is not infrequent. People have quite frequently, even though they have two kidneys, they have quite frequently a kidney infection. Well, if you have only one kidney left, then your life is in danger. The other kidney that is left may fail too. The Supreme Court ruled that that Leonard Marsden would suffer grave emotional distress if he would not be permitted to give a kidney to his twin brother? Well, possibly, potentially, the physical harm done by taking out the kidney is much greater. How can you get around that impasse? I think probably Paul Ramsey is correct that only a Protestant point of view, where you put all chips on the side of sacrificing your life, of freely giving of all of your substance, is probably a better argument. Yes.
I think sometimes, for one thing, I think that here's the problem with a minor, 17 years old, that doesn't know what the consequences will be all of his life. Young people. But the other thing is, how it's presented to the person to give up a kidney. Is it left up to them, okay, but many times I have seen doctors that really make the person to give the kidney guilty if they don't. Because you have the opportunity to save your brother's life, and if you don't, he's going to die.
Yes. Psychologists and psychiatrists are usually called upon to counsel with the patients,
yeah,
to see whether the motive, of what nature the motive is. If it is on the basis of guilt, then all kinds of problems might occur later. One case was related to me by a kidney transplant specialist. A mother had given one of her own kidneys to one of her children, excuse me, to one of her brothers. And later on she had a child who had kidney failure, and she went to the same physician and she wanted the physician to take out the kidney from her brother and give it to her own child.
Oh gosh.
Conflicts arise when the motive is questionable. And I'm convinced that the theological motive is probably still a very good one. That unambiguous willingness to serve is probably still the best and the cleanest motive.
And in the Marsman case, was the brothers that they wanted to take the kidney from, were he mentally retarded?
No.
There was one different.
No,
like
that was a different case, and there are countless such cases where parents go to the physicians and say, "Look, my retarded son is never going to make it in life very far anyway. Why don't you take the kidney out of him and give the kidney to my non-retarded, mentally healthy child who would otherwise die if he wouldn't have a kidney?" How would you judge in that kind of a case?
I can't judge him. I just hope I never face that problem. Mm.
But how? I mean, if you have opinions on this instance, on such a case, somebody else might possibly have opinions. How would you judge?
I don't know. They're all children of God. I don't really know.
They're all children of God. Yes. Yes.
My son, when he was born, had a multitude of congenital deformities, and one of them being bilateral twin ureters and pelvis areas. And there was a point in his life when he was just prior to two where he was on death's doorstep, you know, one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel. And at the same time in Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, there was a need for an immediate kidney transplant. Now we're talking about, he's 17 now, so you're talking about 15 years ago, which was definitely, I feel, in the experimental stage.
Yes.
And I was approached by parents of this child, begging me to help them in a way where I would literally be sacrificing my son, who the doctors gave no chance for survival. And let me tell you, it was a decision that was extremely hard to make, but it didn't take me long to make it. But in the interim period, I still have some very, very, very ambivalent and mixed feelings. But my son is 17 and obviously living and really living a quite normal life.
Mm.
And I keep thinking, when the thoughts occur to me occasionally, you know, what would it have been like had I said, yes, my son is going to die, and therefore, you know, take a chance and
save somebody else.
But it's something that you live with the rest of your life, amongst other things.
Mm.
I don't know what your feelings are about it, but I never told my son that there was this position that came up in his life.
I think
I have avoided it.
Yes, I think that expecting somebody to do a gracious deed cannot be argued. I don't think that a physician can, or anybody can, ask somebody to be gracious to somebody else. That is, you can tell him that a kidney is needed, but you know, don't do very much more. Don't pressure anybody. And you know, the tendency I think among Christians is to say, you know, we try to educate our children to share, you know, and to be gracious. But as soon as you make a law out of grace, then you destroy it. And for that reason, I think you cannot expect anybody. You can present the case, I think, but you can't. Emotionally and intellectually, I think you must separate yourself from that case immediately. That's very difficult, and because that is difficult, there is now usually in hospitals, there are at least two teams. One team that takes care of the well-being of the donor, and the other one that takes care of the well-being of the recipient, and they are in a position of advocacy. Each team is the advocate for his patient, for their patient, and there is a situation of confrontation because of that. And I think that's necessary in order to overcome some of the other problems, or the ethical problems. Yes.
I have another thought. I wonder, even so one dies of a kidney failure, I wonder if it isn't God's will, and if we really have a right to save his or her life. Because some people who have half or have been dead for half a second, or they're coming back with some kind of, and I don't know if that's really so, but a woman doctor writes about that there is something like that one wants to stay, wants to go,
yeah.
Because they have somehow been in contact with a beautiful feeling.
Yes.
And their doctors are fighting to bring that person back.
Yep.
Even my husband has been in that position.
Yes.
Only I shake him back.
Yes. Well,
that's what the doctor says, and I shake and don't go. You know, his heart started beating again.
I think I have begun very much. I mean, we've talked about death and dying already for several sessions, and which does not mean that we shouldn't entertain the thought further. But I have learned to listen to physicians in that kind of a situation, and I have become rather low-keyed in my critique of physicians to try to save, because I don't usually know all the intricacies. What I used to say is that there is, because of the technological imperative which I mentioned at the beginning of this session, physicians feel constrained to use all of the technology. They therefore deny death, as Kubler-Ross teaches. But since I've had some contact with physicians, I don't think that way anymore. It's really a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Physicians usually know better about all of the ifs and buts of a particular case, and very often they judge pragmatically, and the pragmatic judgment is mixed in with compassion for the family, for the patient himself, and the judgment can go either way, either to hold on to life or to let die. And I would say a good degree of situationism, you know, of Joseph Fletcher's situationism, indeed is called for. The problem, however, and this is, you know, where we ethicists indeed have something to say, is that all too often the motive is unclear, is not adequately reflected, and for that reason such discussions are necessary with physicians. But that was what I first engaged in, and I had all my ready-made answers, but now I'm a little bit more careful in saying what physicians should do. I think indeed we've talked about this, and Lowell, you have mentioned this again and again, that indeed I think looking at the situation is very important.
Because we say God gives life and
yes.
takes it away,
yes.
and Jesus promised us not to be afraid to die,
yes.
and it almost seems maybe there is only a beginning
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
Maybe this is just a foretaste,
yes.
and he means for us at any time
yes.
to go into his presence.
Yes. Yeah. Go ahead, Lulu.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, Jesus, though, is also known to us as the great physician and the healer,
that's
the
right.
one who blesses healing.
Yes.
There are many kinds of, I think, of cataract matters, for example, where you have donation. And I don't think anybody would say that it's not the will of God that people should be given their sight.
Yes.
There are complex questions. I wanted to ask a question in connection with the illustration of being asked about, in your case, that I understood it was not, the physician would not move in a situation like that and remove a kidney while the child was still alive, would they? I know, I've heard doctors, the same thing of the teens, I've heard doctors complain about these vultures that are hanging around waiting for somebody to die, and we are fighting to keep the person alive and so on, and yet I thought it was a situation that death had to be pronounced, at least brain death had to be pronounced before that action could be taken, so that really should not have been your personal decision.
No, in heart transplants that's the case, but not in kidney transplants. In kidney transplants, in the situation of a minor like this, the parents indeed can be approached. In the case of a mature person, the patient himself can
be approached. Would they, suppose you give them permission, say, yes, that's fine, would they move in while there is still a...
Yes, in a kidney, indeed. It should be mentioned also that, you see, the heart, we have only one heart, but we have two kidneys. Now, in the heart situation, what you have said indeed applies. But in the kidney transplant, you have a different situation because you have two organs and one kidney can take over perfectly well the function of the other. Still, I have emphasized, I always emphasize with my students, that it is a major intrusion into a person's health to take one kidney. My students usually say, why shouldn't a twin brother or a sibling be required, or why shouldn't he be prevailed upon to give his organ to his twin brother or his sibling, if it meant that it would save his life?
But in weighing risks, though, in this case where the child is on the verge of death, that would be that the surgery itself is a great trauma and great danger to the life of the child.
Yes.
Far better.
That's
in
right.
that case to take any normal child anywhere.
That's right.
Since there's no match anywhere.
That's right. That's right. Now that's the proper argument. That's right. Precisely because the child is in such a precarious situation, the same that holds true also for the retarded child. Ramsey always emphasizes, and sorry, I always come back to Ramsey, he is just the person who has written most about these, but he says, and I've said this before, the more in care, in case of need, of protection a person is, even if there is only the slightest element of hope, the more he should be protected, and not the opposite. It would probably seem more reasonable to say, okay, you know, he's going to kick the bucket anyway, let's take off the kidney. That seems more reasonable. The way the Nazis, said, okay, to the retarded in Bethel, let's take them off. What use are they to society? But no, we Christians are always urged by Paul to help out the suffering and the poor, especially the other who is not so much in need. We can let go his own way. In fact, Jesus at one point says to a person who thinks that he is saved, I have nothing to do with you. If you think that you're saved, that's all right. You go your own way. I have, you're not in need of me. And Paul always says to give, especially to the weak in spirit, give special a preference of protection. And for that reason, I say, okay, a mature person can certainly make a decision, if he wants to make a decision to give one of his organs, that's fine. But if there is any problem, if a person is labile, if he is not quite emotionally stable even, certainly if he is mentally, if he has mental problems, or if he has other mental problems I consider to be part of medical problems, then he should be especially protected.
Wouldn't it be better in that case for the mother to give her own kidney? She has
That's right.
She has relationships with the child, better for the child. She is
right.
healthier than to go to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. I was horrified by the fact that somehow or other someone else found out about your problem and came and approached you.
Yes.
I always think that at least the physician would have approached you, not the parents of another sick child. How did they find out that information? That's really...
There were repercussions on this entire
wow.
thing afterwards that I won't go into
yeah.
because it became a kind of a sticky situation and sticky wicket, right? Yes, indeed. And as far as medical ethics are concerned, there were a lot of repercussions on the part of the physician that was in charge of my child, especially in a hospital the size of and with the reputation of Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. However, I think an important point to bring out at this time is that because of the initiation, I think this was just about the beginning of the initiation of transplants, there was none of the devil's advocate type of thing that you're indicating
right.
that is now.
That was
so
a problem.
Therefore, they had the license and the freedom to work on you either emotionally, physically, or really, there were no guidelines. And maybe in a way, it was a good thing insofar as the repercussions, as they say, came up. There was was asked to sit on some board meetings involved in this, and I have a feeling it never happened again.
Yeah.
Yes. Maybe I should.
Just one more thing. We did have an actor that died at 18 of kidney failure. But you know, before they get to the point where they're even talking about a transplant, the person that is sick has had a lot of damage to other organs also. So it isn't only the fact that you're taking from a healthy, but you're not putting a healthy kidney into a healthy body.
Mm-hmm.
You're putting a healthy kidney into a diseased body.
Mm-hmm. It should be mentioned again that we are in a unique situation with kidney transplants. The best kind of transplant is a live transplant. The homograft and allograft from it's a graft from somebody who is who has a perfect tissue match with you. Especially twin brothers or twin sisters are a very good match. And then parents and child, you know, they can make very sophisticated tissue matches, and they can predict with a fairly high degree of probability what is going to be a good match and what not. So the immune rejection mechanism has to be at a minimum. There is always some rejection of a new organ in anybody's organ, as is the case when we have a common cold. Also, foreign protein enters our body, and our antibodies begin to react against it, and we have complications. And so it is also with a kidney. But it is far worse with a cadaver organ. But the cadaver organs don't raise at all the complicated ethical issues. There are also ethical issues involved in cadaver organs. But because there are much less ethical issues involved in cadaver organs, many physicians and many ethicists argue that we should get away from live transplantation altogether and should develop as much as possible the availability of cadaver organs, that we should have kidney banks, as we have banks for corneas, that we should urge people to carry around little red cards. The Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, for example, argues that every person should carry around a card on which he writes his will in case he should have an accident, that he is willing to donate this or that organ, and that card should be signed by two witnesses and should be updated every 2 years, which has had its advocates, which system has had its advocates and its foes, that is a problem all its own. But and then there are other ethicists who argue that the best road that we should take is develop artificial organs. And that is apparently what has happened. We have put major emphasis on developing artificial kidneys, which is, of course, the least desirable in a certain sense, because you're always tied to the machine, no matter how small the machine is, and it never is really an adequate solution. But I could mention one other thing to get back to that particular issue. What are some of the practices in recruiting for blood for leukemic children, for example? Now, what I've run across in the Albany, New York area is large advertisements in local papers running a whole page with a little boy, in this instance that I usually use in my class demonstrations. It was David so-and-so. The name was mentioned. David so-and-so, surrounded by his family. He's a leukemic boy. He needs so-and-so much blood every year, you know, so-and-so many pints. give blood, you know, to save little David. Bloodmobile will be at that and that location, please give blood. Now, if you know anything about, you know, that's coercion, I think. That's not free consent, that's coercion. Now, it's a much more minor illustration, but it is a good illustration to indicate what kind of questionable practices are used in order to get people to give of, you know, of their body. Blood is replenishable. So it is not such a crucial thing, but it is nevertheless a coercion, I think. Why is it coercive? Well, the blood, you see, is not used for David. That's the problem. The blood is not used for David. Most of the time, blood is thrown away. I have gone to the blood bank. I have a good friend, a hematologist, who runs the blood program of the whole northeastern part of New York State. He has to recruit the blood for the medical center, and it's a big organization, and he has Red Cross volunteers, and he says that one of the worst things is that the Red Cross volunteers get sort of into a competitive spirit. They argue with, you know, in certain localities, they argue with one another. They have a competitive spirit. Who gathers most blood? And so, you know, I once went to the blood bank and said that I wanted to give blood, and he said, oh no, don't come now. Well, the Red Cross volunteers who gather the blood would never say that, because they wanted to gather as much blood as possible. He said, come around 4th of July, or come around the big holidays when people travel a lot, when we have accidents, when we need blood. We don't need blood, so much blood all the time. The layman doesn't know that. You should also give blood, if possible, as directed as possible. But in any case, the issue that I have raised with little David is that a person and a name is mentioned in order to achieve some other aim that is totally unrelated to little David's illness. And so also with kidney transplants, I think those practices, I think, are no longer used now. I think that one is now very careful, and physicians are generally also, of course, because of the malpractice situation and the fear of the press getting a hold of certain stories. These are very explosive stories. Everybody likes to read about such stories. Everybody can understand these things and the predicament in which certain people are. Otherwise, if it would be different, then the Quinlan case would never have become as problematic as it has. The public just eats up with such stories. Yes.
I think quite often that ad is reworded now to say replenish the blood that little David has used in that particular blood bank, rather than for little David. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. What the blood programs you in this country usually need is dedicated donors who know what kind of blood type they have and who know what it is used for, who come again and again, and who come at the time of need, who come when they can be, you know, who are available to be called upon, who are on fire. Blood, giving blood is a great thing, but you shouldn't just give, you know, wildly, you know, once at a time. But you should know if you have a rare blood type, you should be prevailed upon, you should be called upon in the time of need. That's the kind of program that they would like to have. And the way the Red Cross, at least in upstate New York, works, I don't know in other parts how it is doing and how it has worked in the other parts of the country, the way it works in New York State is not very efficient, because they need the volunteers, you see, and the only way they can get the volunteers is to have this kind of enthusiasm, but they are ill-educated. Yes.
Can I hear you say that blood is thrown away?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You mean just?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's thrown away when it gets old. Yeah. It's just.
This
yeah.
is the reason why donors should not come in and donate blood whenever they feel they should, every 6 weeks or every 8 weeks, because sometimes there's no blood needed mm-hmm. in that amount, and as soon as the blood is outdated, you cannot transfuse it to other patients.
We know the life of blood. If it is in the bloodstream, it is you know, red blood cells have a certain lifespan, and then they die. And if they are in the bloodstream, then the bone marrow automatically provides new blood, and it is always replenished, just like all skin or all cells. But when it is taken out of the body, it, you know, there is new rejuvenation taking place, and it just gets old and you have to throw it away. Yes. Way in the back there, excuse me, just a minute, way in the back.
Getting back to Lindsay, I haven't thought through this before, so it may not be reasonable. But is his position strengthened by the fact that transplants are now relatively successful? And what I'm thinking of is cheap grace in reverse. Would his position at the time when transplants were highly questionable and experimental been sort of requesting people to give in the sense of unreasonable giving? I don't know. Am I making any sense to you?
Yes, I think that is probably the major issue that occurred at that time. Physicians were eager to move ahead with this new technology and used any argument that they could get their hands on that would be legitimate.
But what I'm comparing is his position to the Massachusetts Supreme Court at that time in 56 or whenever.
57.
It seems to me that his position would have been weaker than it appears to us today.
Whose position are you talking about?
Ramsey.
Oh, Ramsey. Would have been weaker then than it is today.
Because of the fact that now transplants are successful and acceptable, and at that time they were highly speculative and unsuccessful.
Well, I still think, yes, I think that you have a certain point, but you must still consider the potential harm that is done to the patient, and I don't think that you can use such psychological arguments as the Supreme Court has used at that time today. I think, indeed, I'm still convinced that a theological argument is the best that you can use. But how are you going to get a patient to do something out of, or how are you going to get a donor to do something out of grace? That's like telling somebody to love you. You know, I usually don't do that because I see the problem, but sometimes I'm tempted to tell my boy when he has been a little bit naughty, my 8-year-old now, love your parents and let's be a little lovely. But we know very well that we cannot command somebody to love somebody else. And so also in this instance, I think what you can give the information, and then you can let the person decide. Now, 17 years old, I think, is fairly mature. The issue was raised before whether this person was a minor. The two twins were minors. Increasingly, the courts do not go by the age of legal maturity of 18 years or 21 years, whatever it is. But rather, they also use the emotional maturity, and sometimes the threshold of maturity is pushed back even to 14 years. This has become especially important in the abortion situation, because minors do become pregnant, and just maybe 2 months ago, now a month ago, the Supreme Court extended its ruling of 73 to include minors, that minors can make the decision by themselves, that parents do not need to give consent for a 15-year-old girl to have an abortion. Very interesting, because traditionally, of course, the age of consent begins with, it used to be 21, I think it's 18 now. I would like to get a little bit into the heart transplant situation, because here you have, you know, something which is even more explosive, because you have only one organ. Do you remember how the heart transplant situation developed? All of a sudden in 66 or 67, Bernard in Africa made his first heart transplant. It was like when in 58, I think, the Russians shot their first Sputnik up into space. Now everybody, you know, the Sputnik is something else because there was only one other nation who could do that, the United States. But it meant a tremendous incentive to others in the heart transplant situation to do likewise. Like with the Sputnik, we also had to do the same, at least to do the same, as we then, as a matter of fact, did. And so everybody wanted to do heart transplants to prove the great surgical ability of one physician or of a medical center. And that's why everybody wanted to jump on the bandwagon. Now what happened to the patients that were urged to have a heart transplant? We know that most of them died. The success rate is abysmal, which is the reason why very few heart transplants are done anymore now. But everybody all of a sudden had to do a heart transplant. And they were told, patients were told, no, you have a very enlarged heart, the heart doesn't function anymore properly, your body has suffered already a great deal, your best bet is to have a heart transplant. We know it's very risky, it's experimental, but we think that there is a certain amount of success, or a certain probability of success. And many, many patients gave their yes vote, and they had a heart transplant which was tremendously complicated. Any transplant is tremendously complicated. Judy Swasey and Renee Fox I've quoted before, but Judy Swasey and Renee Fox have spent, I think, a semester at the Stanford University Medical Center studying, from a sociological perspective, the ramifications of a kidney transplant. Heart transplant is even more complicated, because again here, you need a vital organ, as vital as possible. But you cannot have a vital organ except that a patient has very recently died. Usually, the best kind of patient that you have that you get is a young man or a young woman who has had a recent auto accident. And men seem to be more prone to accidents, especially the motorcycle riders out in California. You know, motorcycle riding is very dangerous. When I get into this with my students, I usually say that I myself have in former years driven a motorcycle. I'm not all so much against riding motorcycles. The proverbial motorcycle accident victim comes into the hospital with a total brain damage. The brain has ceased to start to function altogether. The respirator is still running, so as to keep the patient alive. The physicians are obviously interested to get some of his organs, kidneys, and at that time when the heart transplants were going on, hearts. Okay, it's a very hectic situation. Then consent has to be asked for. There's particularly one instance where a young motorcycle accident victim came into the hospital. Forgot his name now. This is the case which Judy Swasey and Fox talk about. There was no next of kin to ask for consent, because the boy had been alienated from his parents. The boy had been alienated. Usually motorcycle riders, you know, tend to be of a type that they are, you know, they are free floaters, you know. So you don't find the next of kin. The only persons that could be found were his brothers, in quotation marks, which were not his real brothers, but which were so much attached to this boy that they were immensely struck by grief and emotion. To find their brother in a situation of approaching death, so the physicians considered this party, these group of brothers, the only group that could give legal consent for a heart transplant, and a heart transplant was performed. Not in this instance, but all too often in other instances, then the physicians are sued because of, you know, it is said, let me quote another instance with Professor Shumway, who is the only physician, incidentally, at Stanford University who still continues doing heart transplants because, and very rarely, once a year, I think, he does a heart transplant. And in 1973 or so, he did a heart transplant, taking a heart out of a man that had been shot by somebody else. and the criminal that had done the shooting had shot the patient into the head, and the patient was for all practical purposes dead. Now, when it came to a court hearing about the criminal action of shooting, the criminal defended himself by saying, "I didn't kill the patient, Dr. Somway killed the patient because the heart was still beating." And it came to a court action, and it was resolved only last year. Of course, Somway appeared on television. I had seen him in the news, and it was written up in the New York Times, the criminal was justly convicted, as I think he should have been. But he was convicted also on the updated determination of death. Death is no longer determined only by the presence of heartbeat, but now also, since 1968 at least, also by the activity of brain waves. And if brain waves are absent, and if there is no longer any hope of life, then there are certain tests that can be done, whether the heart will spontaneously beat, which was the case in the Quinlan case. Incidentally, also in the Quinlan case, the girl did have brain activity still, which was the decisive criterion for not stopping the, ceasing the respirator. One fictitious, yes, go ahead.
I just wondered, Dukuli and DeBakey, did they ever do any open heart, heart transplants, or were they mainly with the open heart surgery?
I think that they did perform heart transplants. The book Hearts talks about this. They don't do it anymore, though, but they did do heart transplants. Karp, I think, one of the last patients received an artificial heart by DeBakey. DeBakey has been, because of the ethical problems involved, has increasingly gone into the development of artificial hearts. But I think that team there, the Texas Heart Institute, has done transplants. I'm not quite sure.
They don't do any more. They don't valve artificial hearts.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Cooley does mainly valves, artificial valves. We had one person here on the staff, Paul Bosch, who has had in 1973 an artificial heart valve. I have seen Cooley put one of these artificial valves into a patient. It was very fascinating to see. If you ever have a chance, try to get there to the, if you're ever in Houston, try to get to the Texas Heart Institute at Methodist Hospital and observe them operate. And I've also seen DeBakey. DeBakey does mainly coronaries. And Cooley does artificial valves. But DeBakey is very much involved in developing artificial organs and artificial hearts. There's a great feud between the two, incidentally. I did want to mention to you one fictitious case, which Dartmouth pre-med students were confronted with in a test. And let me ask you what you think of it. The test question was a fictitious case, and they were told that it's fictitious. A father decides to give his heart to his son who is severely handicapped because of a heart problem. The father tells himself he is has achieved the epitome of his success, and that his son, if he would receive this perfect tissue transplant, a tissue matching heart, his son would be able to get much further. In any case, he has lived a fairly full life, and the son should have a chance for such a full life too. If you were the heart transplant physician, what would you choose to do? Confronted with this decision. Would you do it? You could not do legally. Okay, that's one point. That's one point that you could develop in an essay to answer the question. Why couldn't you do it legally? That's right. The father would be killed.
That's almost suicide. I couldn't accept it.
Yeah.
If the father shot himself in the head, leaving a note.
But there is a. If the father would shoot himself in the head, and then that's right, he could. That could be done then. But I hope physicians don't only judge on the basis of what is permitted by the law. I hope that they have also morally thought through the reasons for the existence of the law. What would be the moral objection? Yes, I think from a Christian perspective, thou shalt not kill. That is most important mandate. But if you think through the situation, the chances of the boy surviving is less than the chance of the father suffering harm. You know, the father will be dead, and the mandate on the physician is to do less harm by the operation than the potential good. You know, the risk must be considerably less than the potential good that is derived. And in this instance, you know, this would be the answer, I think, the proper medical answer. The potential harm would be far greater, you know, inestimably greater than the potential good derived.
I have one more question. You haven't brought it up yet, but how about this couple in New York, this theologian's wife and her 80s, suicide pact, because they decided they didn't want to live and grow old and be handicapped?
Yes, those are the Van Dusens.
Yes, right.
Yes?
Do you want to repeat the question? Because it's quite a big argument about it. So the tape hears it. No, people are the tape.
Yes?
I'd like to ask a question about the Van Dusen who in their 80s chose suicide rather than living to be elderly and handicapped.
And you're asking me what I think about that? Well, as a matter of fact, in a faculty seminar at the Albany Medical Center, we discussed that particular case in the conjunction of a series of seminars and discussions on suicide. And we have, in previous sessions here, discussed that case too. Yes, but maybe it might be meaningful to raise it. I don't know how willing the audience is here to debate it at length. Something should be said about the case to fill in the group about what had actually happened. Do you want to do that? Are you informed? Are you informed to?
No, I'm not. Only what I read in the paper.
Well, okay, maybe then I can. These were older. This was an older couple. It was a theologian couple mainly, a well-known theologian. Van Dusen was the president of Union Theological Seminary in New York City for many, many years. He had become old in fairly good health considering his age, but he had begun to have quite, you know, strong handicaps, arthritis and certain problems that come up when one is old. He was in his 80s. They also had a large house in Manhattan, which increasingly became difficult for them to maintain. And they decided that their sons had talked over with them for years and years that something must change. They can't take care of the house anymore adequately. They should go to a nursing home. This was the decision on the part of their children. And they were very reluctant to do that. Now, they had thought through for years and years this mandate on the part of the church not to commit suicide. And they decided that under certain circumstances suicide could be performed. That is, a person can take his life. So they have written down a rather good theological statement, theologically argued for statement indicating that under certain circumstances it might be permissible for a person to take his own life. Thereupon, after having written that, they put it on the table, they took an overdose of sleeping pills, both doctor and also Mrs. Van Dusen. They were admitted to one of the large hospitals in New York City. Somebody had come to them a few hours after this, 6 or 7 hours after they had taken that overdose of pills, they had come for a routine visit at a time when they usually come, and they knew that the Van Dusens were in, but they didn't answer, so they thought something had happened. They broke into the house, they found them with the overdose of sleeping pills and with the suicide pact. They brought them to the hospital. Just think of the dilemma of the physicians. What should you do? Should you revive them, or should you do anti-suicide therapy, or should you permit them to die? What would your judgment be? If you were a physician, what would you do?
Yes? I would permit them to die.
Yes.
Is there anyone who would permit them, who would do anti-suicide therapy?
I would.
Yes. I would vote for that too, incidentally. But at that time, I had voted for, we had also a little vote in our group. And I voted for, this is how I voted. That I would revive them, but nevertheless that I would consider it just, I would consider suicide under certain circumstances to be just. But nevertheless, that it is my obligation to revive this patient since he is now entrusted in my care. If he had committed suicide and I had known nothing about it, I could morally be in favor of it. This is the way I argued. Now, there is a great debate in the medical community about whether a suicide victim is always a mental patient or not. And there is good medical indication that an overwhelming majority, 85% or even higher, 90% almost, of suicide victims or suicide candidates, persons who attempt suicide, are mentally incapacitated. I have read an article compiled by a well-known English psychiatrist. He had done a study on 100 suicide cases, attempted and successful suicide cases in England, and it was written up in the leading English Journal of Psychiatry. It's called British Journal of Psychiatry, on 100 suicide cases. And the overwhelming evidence is that people who commit suicide are mentally ill. And for that reason, physicians in most instances would be well advised to not take seriously the suicide attempt and to try to revive. I think morally, a physician is really in a bind when he's confronted with a suicide victim, but I think in such a situation where you have an emergency, where you do not have time to think through, at this particular instance, all of the ramifications of the case and the history of the particular patient, it is the mandate of the physician to try to revive. Let me tell you how it actually happened. And when we talked about this first, I because we got involved so much in the debate, I didn't do that. But the case actually ended in this way. That even on the way to the hospital, Dr. Van Dusen regurgitated a good portion of the pills, and therefore he hung on to life for about 3 weeks. The psychiatrists in particular thought that possibly, because he had done that, there was an incompatibility in his whole system to the sleeping pills, and that he was therefore not very serious about committing suicide. Mrs. Van Dusen's overdose of sleeping pills was successful and she died in the hospital. They could not do anything anymore about her. She the drug had taken such a heavy effect that she died and they couldn't do anything. They pumped out her stomach and they did whatever they could, but the interval of her taking the pills and she actually arriving at the hospital and the therapy beginning was too long. With Dr. Van Dusen, it was difficult because apparently even before they found him, or at least on the way to the hospital, he had regurgitated a good portion of the pills, and he hung on to life for about 3 weeks and then died. But it's new in the history of theology in any case, because we have now this case, and I would still argue that under certain circumstances, again, because of the basic compassion that is our mandate, it is possible, I think, for the Christian to look upon a person with compassion and permit him to commit suicide, or at least to condone once suicide is committed. I think that it would be, for example, for the minister, it would be a very cruel and harsh thing not to bury a person of his congregation that has committed suicide, but that used to be the practice. And I think church law and many denominations still make it binding upon the minister not to bury such a person, which I think is cruel.
Can I ask you one
yes.
question? As I felt very strongly, you know, that when it meant for someone to die, that most probably Jesus meant it that way. If I had kidney problems, which I most probably will have, it was said so, because of kidney stones, and I would go to the hospital and I would refuse. I want to die. Would I have that right?
Yes, but physicians wouldn't necessarily give you the right. It all depends upon the situation. Let me tell you about one circumstance which is quite typical. A terminal cancer patient was in a hospital. A nurse told me this, an older black nurse who was in my lectures. And we talked about death and dying, and she told me about this instance which she had experienced. This cancer patient that was in her hospital was once her colleague. He was a lab technician. And was her colleague and also personal friend. Now, she went once to visit him when he was in his terminal situation, and his wife was there. And he was under the oxygen, he had an oxygen mask, and he was fully conscious, but he knew that his time had come, and he knew that he would die soon. A resident was on duty, but at a certain point, he simply took off the mask and didn't want to have any more oxygen. Whereupon the little beepers and the little apparatuses that are around the patient immediately began to sound the alarm that this patient is in highest danger. The two women who were at that time, I suppose, at the end of their 50s, quickly went out of the room, talked about it, and they said, that's his will, and we will permit him to, you know, to die in peace now. He doesn't want to live anymore, and they had solved all problems. This man had a firm death, and so they were in the room, and the resident who was in charge and who was in care, who was the primary physician for that patient at that moment, rushed in and said, we must put back the mask. The man is going to die. And the woman calmly said, no. This man wants to die now, and his time has come. There is little hope for him anymore. Let him die. And he was in a frenzy. He didn't know what to do, because the physician has more authority than a nurse, and certainly than the wife of the patient. But finally, the physician gave in, and there was a legal aftermath in the hospital. The hospital protected the physician. The nurse and also the wife of the patient went to the hospital administration and urged them to stand behind the physician so that no legal repercussions came. Because, you know, when a patient dies, the coroner has to come, or some legal things have to be done, and the cause of death has to be determined. And I think in this instance, what the nurse said, if I can reconstruct it, the patient can... The hospital can simply, cover over certain circumstances. The patient simply died of natural causes, which in fact was the case. Maybe at some time this will no longer be necessary, and the hospital can be quite honest. But the law doesn't really catch up with morality all the time. I think I must always emphasize, and when I was working with Dr. Grunberg in psychiatry the last term at the medical center in Albany, we have always emphasized, if something is legal, that doesn't necessarily make it moral, as in the abortion ruling, for example. I consider the abortion ruling of 73 immoral. Nevertheless, it is legal. When something is legal, that doesn't make it moral. The law is not necessarily an indication of the moral stature. Or if something is legal, that doesn't necessarily mean that something is moral. But not all cases are like that, you see.
And trust the person himself, even. I think I did a hospital visitation for 3 months, 2 years ago, and then I got very ill myself afterwards, in fact. I remember one woman, she was a letter wife, her husband died, he was 74, I felt that she ought to permit it, and she didn't know he's going to walk out of here with me, we're going to have some good years left, and they did.
Yes.
And I myself was just 60, and I wanted to die.
Yes.
I'm fed up with begging.
Yes.
And I said, let the Lord find another beggar. Let me die.
Yes.
Well, I wasn't sick. I just simply am fed up with begging.
Yes.
All.
Yes.
And there again, the doctors don't let me.
Yes.
In fact, one of the doctors up just recently went all the way along just to make sure I got everything I needed. But
yes.
I was back for a second major operation within a month after I visited all these sick people. I was sick for the name. Didn't know.
Yes.
But I mean, you get to us. Let the Lord find himself another beggar.
That's right. I think we have to close, but let me just urge you to see one film. It's a film produced by, what's his name now again? The film came out quite recently, and it is shown on public television, on public television. It's simply called Dying.
Dying.
Yes, it's produced by Michael Romer.
Right.
Yes. and it's an excellent film. And the attitude, what Carol just said about the attitude of a dying patient, I think that's imperative. And in this film, four dying patients are filmed in their final months, in the final months of their life. And it's a beautiful film, and you have it. I don't have time now to recount all of this, but especially the Black Minister reminded me of your attitude. The Black Minister was photographed. He took his problem, his illness. He had cancer. He took it into the into his congregation. He preached about dying, not necessarily about his own dying, but he included the congregation into this, and it is touching how the congregation was in fact in this instance the extended family, and how the congregation helped him care for this dying man. And then when the last hours came, he died in his own family, in his own house, and his children and his grandchildren were around, and he hugged his grandchildren. And they were holding his hand in his last hour when he was dying. Yes, there was a hand back there. Yes.
I think so, that if we are going to take a strong stand, which I support, of not trying to perpetuate life, then we need to look at a lot of things that we do and accept them. I'm thinking now the nursing home. Whole thing that we've gotten into, I know that nursing homes are filled with terribly, terribly lonely people.
That's
all
right.
The fun and games that people perpetuate by coming in and crafts and all that, which is wonderful, still does not take away a terrible empty place in that person.
That's right.
If we're going to be so insistent on the one hand, then somehow our society, or at least church people, are going to have to look
right
to the other side.
Exactly. As in the abortion situation, we should not, if we are so adamant about the immorality of abortion, then we should do also something about the causes why abortions are necessary. But the loneliness of young people, the split up families, the centrifugal families in our society, and so also with lonely people. Why are older people so lonely? If we are so adamant about maintaining life, then we should also develop at least an equal further to eliminate the causes for loneliness in society.
There has to be a substitute for that void, or else
exactly.
The extension of their life is so meaningless that it's really, in my estimation,
cruel. That's right. That's right. I think that we could continue this discussion at another time. If you are interested, then I'll do another session. I realize that there is a constant flow, and maybe we can just continue talking about medical ethics at some other time.